Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to introduce our guest this week, Lauren Templeton. Lauren is the great niece of Sir John M. Templeton and is the founder and president of Templeton & Phillips Capital Management, LLC. She currently serves on the board of directors at Fairfax Financial Holdings, Fairfax India Holdings Corporation, and Canadian Solar as well. As always, for those of you out in the audience, do please feel free to post your questions and comments in the live chat throughout the presentation, but do keep in mind we will hold those until we get to the end of things, just to keep it nice and smooth. As well, please let us know where you're coming from so we can go ahead and say hey to all of you international audience members out there. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead and hand things over to Lauren, and we can go ahead and jump into her presentation today.
Greetings from Lookout Mountain, Tennessee. Thank you so much for asking me to come spend a few minutes with you today reviewing my process and philosophy for investing. As Graham mentioned, my name is Lauren Templeton. I'm the founder and president of Templeton & Phillips Capital Management. We are a value investing boutique located in Tennessee. We have a commingled long-short fund. It is predominantly long, and we have separately managed accounts. We focus on global value investing. I am the author of Investing the Templeton Way, the market-beating strategies of value investing's legendary bargain hunter, Sir John Templeton. And we also offer a free periodic newsletter called the Maximum Pessimism Report. That is available for free on our website, templetonandphillips.com. So please feel free to sign up and we will share our thoughts on the market with you periodically. It used to be a monthly newsletter, and we have learned that that's very hard to have original thoughts every month. So I manage the business with my husband. I'm the CEO. He is the CIO. I'm going to include our contact information in the back of the presentation. If there are questions that I cannot answer for you today, or you just think of new questions after the presentation, please reach out to us directly. We love to correspond with individual investors and always take the time to reply to emails. Maybe a few days late, but we will get back to you. I am very passionate about investing. I have been investing in the financial market since I was a young child. I think many of you who have heard me present before know that my father was very involved with developing me as an investor as a child. So I was allowed to pick one stock per month. He would buy me a share, and the stock certificate would hang on the walls of my room. My room was literally wallpapered in stock certificates. And he put me to bed with stories about the magic of compounding. I say that in almost every presentation because compounding is truly magical. And part of my passion as an investor is to share that magic with others and hopefully help people grow wealth, whether that's through partnering with me in my investment business, or just lighting a simple spark so that you continue to educate yourself and become financially literate. I know many of you are seasoned investors, so you're probably well down the path, but please share my contact information with others that are learning about investments. I really like to nurture particularly young investors on their journey in learning about investment. So as you may know, I always start my presentations with a few quotes from Sir John Templeton to really set the tone. Give me just 1 second. I'm trying to get to the presentation. Okay. So today we will be reviewing my investment philosophy and then the investment process. I will give you a brief commentary on today's market And then lastly, I will review with you one of my existing positions in the portfolio that we really like so that you can understand how we are consistently applying our process. So let's start with a few quotes. I think this really sets the tone. Many of you have seen these quotes before, but they're highly relevant to today's market. So the first is, if you want to have better performance than the crowd, you must do things differently from the crowd. A major cause of higher prices is higher prices. But when the trend is reversed, then lower prices lead to still lower prices. To buy when others are despondently selling and to sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest ultimate reward. Bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy, and the time of maximum optimism is the best time to sell. An investor who has all the answers doesn't even understand the questions. And then lastly, people are always asking me where the outlook is good. But that's the wrong question. The right question is, where is the outlook most miserable? So our investment process at Templeton and Phillips Capital Management is focused on value. We rely upon Sir John's approach toward bargain hunting, which is led by quantitative reasoning. When we believe we have uncovered a statistical bargain, we then turn to valuation and fundamental analysis to measure the intrinsic value of the firm and compare our estimated value versus the market's estimate seen through the share price. I believe contrarian views are rational outcomes. The most successful investments we have ever made were the result of buying companies that were temporarily out of favor. And the only way a stock can become a bargain is due to the lack of buyers. So there is a really great documentary on John Templeton. For those of you who are interested, it's called Contrarian. And I will make sure and post a link to that documentary on our website, as well as to Twitter and LinkedIn after this presentation, so that if you're looking for some entertainment this evening, it's a great video. And it just reviews his contrarian spirit, which I think was a very important part of his investment discipline and process. So in our office, we do have a slogan, and that is trouble is opportunity. I think it may appear backwards to you, but this is a nameplate we keep on all of our desks here as a reminder of what our investment philosophy is. In fact, at my old company, the name of the company wasn't on the door. It just said trouble is opportunity. And I thought it was really great because if an investor walked through the doors of my office and said, I don't get it, what do you mean? I thought, oh, well, we're probably not a great match. But if somebody came in and said, yeah, you know, that is my life philosophy. I understand the application of that philosophy to investing. I thought, you know, our chances of being successful together with me as the manager and you as an investor are pretty high here. And so I thought it's just a great slogan we like to remind ourselves of. In our experience, the best bargains appear during periods of market duress and pessimism. Bargains, as you know, can periodically appear in individual companies, industries, but the best case scenario is when the entire market is selling off. During times of maximum pessimism, even high-quality growth firms can be purchased at a bargain. A good example of that is we had the opportunity to purchase Amazon in March of 2020. So the time of maximum pessimism is definitely the best time to buy, in my opinion. Now, our process is a bit similar to other investment managers. We first start with a quantitative screening process. Sir John believed in letting the numbers lead him to bargains, and we do the same. Things have changed a lot since he managed capital. When he was managing money, data was really hard to come by. You know, Microsoft Excel didn't exist, neither did Bloomberg. So you really had a competitive advantage if you could go out and collect this data, organize it, and rank companies. One of my favorite memories of spending time with him is being in his conference room in the Bahamas, and he said, you know, I want you to take this list of companies and rank them by peg ratio. Please come back and visit me in a month and present your results. And I was able to say, look, I can do it right here with Bloomberg and Excel, and you can have the results in 30 seconds. And he was just so excited by that. So today we have, everybody has access to the data. Sitting at home, you have access to this, most of the same data that I do, and you have lots of tools to organize it. So we start with an initial quantitative screening process of approximately 24 proprietary rankings to locate potential bargains. We focus on the bottom quartile of results in our search for pricing anomalies and irrational valuations. The firm's screens are applied across a diverse spectrum of measures to help eliminate blind spots, biases, and to add diversification to the portfolio. Sir John always told me that there were over 100 measuring sticks of value, and that you should often reevaluate the metrics you're using to rank companies. You will see on this page some pretty ordinary valuation metrics that a lot of investors use. As you know, investing is really part art and part science. It takes, I think, years to learn which metrics are best suited for particular industries, and when it might be time to modify the metrics that you are heavily relying on during your screening process. So we're constantly reevaluating these metrics and placing more emphasis on some over others. So the next step in our process is to estimate intrinsic value. In the hunt for value, low share price multiples are often the best, but as you know, low multiple stocks can be vastly overpriced too. So this is what we call the value traps. And so we employ valuation tools, including discounted cash flow models that forecast disparate scenarios. An expected value is calculated from the outputs, and if the upside is 50% or more or greater, the company is then subjected to fundamental analysis to determine the cause of the mispricing. So we're looking for 50% upside to our approximation of intrinsic value. And if we find that opportunity, then we're looking for the cause of the mispricing. As you all know, discounted cash flow models are constrained by the quality of the assumptions, but valuable insight accrues during the modeling process, revealing the nature of the business and its available resources. The process also reveals other useful ratios, including the firm's long-run PE and the market's fundamental assumptions that are embedded in the current stock price. In addition to discounting cash flows, we also calculate long-term PE ratios on earnings 5 to 10 years in the future. And just to give you some indication of what John Templeton considered a bargain, he wanted 5 years below 5x and the 10-year below 2x. So that shows you how selective he was. Okay, I think I've missed a slide. Here we go. So investing is definitely a competitive undertaking, and gaining an edge is very difficult, in my opinion. We believe that there are three sources of alpha, which is, as you know, excess return available to investors in the market. The first source is better information. You can have better information than the crowd. And most managers lie in this category. So they're trying to gain an edge through better information, leading to more accurate earnings estimates. And sell side research is really designed for this group of investors. The second source of alpha available to you in the market is to build a better model. So these are managers that focus on algorithms and building black boxes, and you know, they want to be quick and build a better model. And these are managers like Renaissance Tech, AQR, DE Shaw. We don't really play in this area too much. The last source of alpha that we think is available to investors is really better behavior. And there are the fewest number of managers in this category. And this is the area where you're going to find Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett, and John Templeton. And while we do seek an edge in all three areas, really it's the mastery of better behavior that we consider our edge. And so this really gets into the category of, or the subject of, behavioral finance, which is an extremely interesting subject to study. We believe our investment performance depends upon our continued ability to make wise purchases when the most value is present in the market, during panics, crises, recessions, and bear markets. Every investor makes money in a bull market, while decisions made during bear markets will determine an investor's true long-term success rate. So I think it's important to reflect on that, that if you really want to distinguish your investment returns from the crowd in a positive way, you need to focus on your behavior during a bear market. So that is your opportunity to distinguish your returns. I keep on getting a little bit out of order. But the last step in our investment process is to identify whether a company earns a place in our portfolio. So it's really the purchase decision. And what we do when we're deciding whether to purchase a company is that we first look to see if there is any available cash in the portfolio. We like to keep cash at 10% or less. There have been times in my career where we've had as much as 30% cash. That's highly atypical. So typically we're dealing with a 10% or less cash position to deploy during a crisis event. If cash isn't available, we use what we call John Templeton's 50% rule. And the 50% rule is that we are constantly maintaining a list of our securities, and the our calculation of the upside to our calculation of intrinsic value for each of the securities. So if we can find an opportunity that offers 50% more upside, we think that merits switching from one investment to another. So those are the first two steps to taking advantage of a crisis. The second step is a really important one, and I've talked about it in many presentations, but I'm going to say it again because I think it can really help you. Is that we maintain a wish list of securities in our desk drawer. So this is extremely important. These are securities that we've researched in advance, companies that we would like to own shares of, that we greatly admired, that just aren't priced right for us. And we keep them in our desk drawers because even during a market panic, seasoned investors can get upset, nervous, and make really poor decisions. I mean, you see it all the time. The psychology of being a value investor and doing the right thing and going in during a crisis event is so tough for people to do that anything you can implement to skew the odds in your favor is a positive. Keeping this wish list of securities in your desk drawer is important because when you pull it out, you really shift your mental focus from focusing on losses in your portfolio to instead focusing on the opportunities the sell-off presents. And we've been able to pick up a lot of great positions using this wish list strategy, and it's super powerful. I mean, when the list comes out, the whole attitude of the office changes. I mean, it really gives you, maybe it's the illusion of control, but you feel like you have more control over the market and it's less panicky. And it's just a great tool for all of you to use. So I encourage you as you're researching companies to employ this tool. And so to do this, we are continuously studying attractive firms on a long-term basis and their estimated intrinsic value. This is an important aspect of our investment process as it changes our perspective to one of looking forward to market disruptions, including panics and bear markets. So we actually really look forward to these events. A bit strange as that may seem, we know that that's our opportunity to distinguish our returns going forward. So the last step in the process really is we have our stocks fall into two categories, compounders and tactical discounts. So a compounder we would buy and hold for years. They're rarely discounted. They're probably on our wish list. We're picking them up usually in a market event where the whole market's down and we have the opportunity to go in and buy the shares. It's rare. It requires patience. And again, that wish list is really important to picking up these compounders at the right price. The other area that our stocks fall, or the other category that our stocks fall into, is what we call tactical discounts. So these are sudden disruptions in the market, and they're usually highly idiosyncratic. So I'm thinking about things like the swine flu crisis or the Japanese tsunami. And often in these cases, we'll go in and buy a basket of stocks because we don't have time to go do all the fundamental analysis that we normally do. So it will push up our position count, but we will employ a basket of stocks, usually consolidate it later down the road into one position or even close out the position. So these are two different categories that we find opportunities in the market. So as you all know, I think if you are heavily involved with Guru Focus, market disruptions, crises, bear markets are just a staple to investing. They're always there. They're much more common than we think. I used to know all the statistics about how common a bear market is and how often a correction occurs. They're very frequent, okay? But what I want you to take away from this presentation today is that you are probably going to spend one third of your life in a bear market. So go ahead and get used to it and harness the power of the bear. This is your golden opportunity to distinguish your returns from your competitors, your peers, your neighbor, is your behavior in a bear market. This is a golden opportunity for you. So markets, panics, and crises events are no problem for the man on the screen known as Homo economicus. I have been really obsessed with Homo economicus since college. I was an econ major, and it always struck me as crazy that the concept of Homo economicus is taught in every finance class, because Homo economicus really is required for capital asset pricing model to work or arbitrage pricing theory. It's really a tenet to modern day finance. And what homo economicus is, it's a term that academics use to describe man as a perfectly rational wealth maximizer. Now, I can't see your faces, and I usually ask for people to raise their hands, but how many of you think that man is a perfectly rational wealth maximizer? I'm hoping you guys are all laughing. Or that are women perfectly rational wealth maximizers? My husband looking at my shoes would definitely tell you no, I make very poor decisions in that category. Investors over the centuries and decades have proven that homo economicus is just a myth. Market participants are more often than not highly irrational. Humans routinely make poor decisions and underperform a large assortment of asset classes. And the next slide is a slide that I love from Dalbar. And they produce this data every year. But what it shows is that the average investor underperforms almost every asset class over the short term and the long term. People are terrible investors. And there are lots of reasons why humans are hardwired to fail as investors. And behavioral finance is a very interesting subject. And there are many important books on this subject that I encourage you all to read. We will not go down that rabbit hole today, but I have recently read a pretty easy beginner's book on behavioral finance by Morgan Housel called The Psychology of Money. If you haven't read it, I think you will all enjoy it. It will definitely make you want to learn more about behavioral finance. But in general, investors are really terrible decision makers because they aren't patient. So I think that's what it boils down to. Now, earlier in the presentation, we reviewed a few of John Templeton's quotes, and I love them because I think that they are highly relevant today, perhaps more relevant today than any time in the past 20 years. He seeded my business in 2001, so 20 years ago, and I still like to go back and review his philosophy. And I entered the market in 1998 during the dot-com mania. I know many investors out there, and because I can't see your faces and I would never guess at your age, many investors are too young in the market today to even remember the dot-com era, but I'm happy to share with you a few lessons from that, because I think it's highly relevant today. And valuation still matters, okay? So when I entered the industry back in 1998, it was the new economy that drove the markets as the internet and the companies seeking to capitalize on it transfixed investors' imaginations into a mindless stream of buy orders. My first job was at Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. I was a sales assistant on to two brokers. I didn't have a computer at my desk. We, you know, took orders by phone, put them up in the tube. They went to the back office, but people were going crazy over internet stocks. So think Webvan. These were the go-go days of the 1990s. And of course, value was dead. People like Warren Buffett just didn't get it. That was the thought. You know, it was a new economy. Sir John at that time had already sold his mutual fund business back in 1992, and he was retired and managing money in the Bahamas on behalf of his philanthropies. And I recall visiting with him shortly after I entered the industry, and I made this horrible, regrettable mistake. I will always remember it. We were sitting by the pool at the Lyford Key Club, and I asked him, "What tech stocks are you buying?" And instead of embarrassing me, which I probably deserved that at that point, he was always polite. And he shared with me one story from his childhood. When he and my grandfather gathered as young boys, along with many other neighbors and onlookers, at dusk one night outside of a house near the town square. They waited in great anticipation as a man walked out the front door, waved to the crowd, then briefly stepped back in, flipped a switch, and the lights came on and lit up the house, and everybody cheered. What a wonderful moment. It was the spread of electricity, and it changed the world forever. However, Sir John had studied electricity stocks, and he said the time to have gotten out was 3 years prior. He then walked me through similar investment manias that unfolded in radios, automobiles, air travel, and televisions. From there, it was really easy to see that he believed a similar fate awaited dot-com stocks, trading at well over 100 times earnings, if there were any earnings at all. And a few years later, I learned that at the time, Sir John had actually sold short approximately $400 million worth of tech stocks, approximately 11 days prior to their IPO lockup expiration. It was generally reported in the press and by other associates that he made nearly 90% on average on this strategy. So I'll point this out to you. It's detailed in my book, Investing the Templeton Way. It is a great strategy for investors to even consider today. And today it's super easy because there are whole websites dedicated to IPO lockup expiration dates. So I encourage you to research it. But as you know, this strategy makes a lot of sense. You know, as a value investor, anytime you hear IPO, the hairs on your arm should probably rise a little bit. I always think, or my dad told me that, you know, by the time an IPO gets to you, Lauren, it's been passed over by so many people, you need to turn it down. But when you really think about it, you know, the people that are most knowledgeable about a business are the insiders. Okay. So if they have decided to pursue an IPO or even a secondary issue, odds are pretty good that the stock price is high. And if the stock price is high, you're probably not going to get a bargain. So if value investing is your strategy and locating bargains, if that's important to you, then, you know, IPOs are probably not a fertile hunting ground for you. And I don't want to disparage any other investing style strategy. I think many different strategies have merit. As an investor, it's your responsibility to find what sort of gels best with your personality. A lot of people are not cut out to be value investors. If you know that you have a hard time controlling your emotions, you know, value investing is probably not for you. Or if you are not a patient person, all of those skills can be acquired. It's painful to acquire them over time, I know. But anyway, I think, you know, you just have to find the strategy that makes the most sense for you and where your personality is best suited. But sitting here today, I can easily see that the electric vehicle maker Tesla trades at 128 times earnings and 11.3 times estimated sales. Now, I do not want to get into a discussion on Tesla in the Q&A portion of this podcast. I don't own Tesla. I'm not short Tesla. And I have enough information on Tesla to be really dangerous. So I'm not looking to pick a fight with anyone. And in all fairness, it really is correct to say that Tesla is revolutionizing the automobile industry. And you can take it a step forward and argue that Tesla should not be compared with any of the dot-com era stocks. And I do think that's fair. Because the lesson I want to share with you today is about a dot-com success story that also revolutionized technology in the 90s and has been a smashing success ever since. Let's take a quick look at Microsoft, and you will see some data points about Microsoft on the screen. First introduced in 1985, Microsoft Windows has maintained its desktop software prowess ever since, with a formidable 77% market share. From a 1990s tech bulls perspective, Microsoft has been living the dream, for sure. The company still dominates the market it created decades ago, as evidenced by over 1 billion users. But far from a one-trick pony, in the last 20 years, Microsoft successfully tackled the gaming market, not to mention fought off Google during its transition into cloud-based desktop with Office 365. But despite its myriad of successes during the past 30 years or so, investors that bought the shares in the height of the dot-com mania in the late 1990s had to wait 17 years to generate a positive return. Yeah, 17 years. And in hindsight, it's relatively easy to see that back in 1998, Microsoft's price-to-sales ratio of 21.9 times and PE of 61 times had already accounted for almost two decades of success that would follow. In 2021, in the United States, we count no less than 718 stocks trading at more than 20 times sales. So what are the chances that these 718 companies will be as least as successful as Microsoft? Probably not good. And to really put this into perspective, I always like this quote. It was from a Bloomberg article in 2012 from Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems. And this might be familiar with you, but recall that at the peak of the dot-com mania, Sun Microsystems traded at 10 times revenue. Okay, we're talking about 718 companies trading at 20 times revenue. Sun Microsystems was trading at 10 times revenue. And I'm going to read this quote to you because I think it does a nice job of summing it all up. At 10 times revenues, to give you a 10-year payback, I have to pay you 100% of revenues for 10 straight years in dividends. That assumes I can get that by my shareholders. That assumes I have zero cost of goods sold, which is very hard for a computer company. That assumes zero expenses, which is really hard with 39,000 employees. That assumes I pay no taxes, which is very hard. And that assumes you pay no taxes on your dividends, which is kind of illegal. And that assumes with zero R&D for the next 10 years, I can maintain the current revenue run rate. Now, having done that, would any of you like to buy my stock at 64? Do you realize how ridiculous those basic assumptions are? You don't need any transparency, and you don't need any footnotes. So, I will say that, and I am not looking to pick a fight with anybody because I respect so many different minds in the investment industry, but many of those stocks in the 718 with price to sales multiples greater than 20 times are positions in the well-known ARK Innovation Fund, which we have really successfully used as a tactical short several times over the past few months, really since the beginning of the year. And we have great respect for Kathy Wood. I think she's smart. I love to listen to her. But valuation matters to me. I do think it matters the price you pay for an asset. And that Microsoft example really hammers that point, that investors who bought those shares at the height of the dot-com mania had to wait 17 years for a positive return. And, you know, the Scott McNeely quote is just a bit ridiculous, in my opinion. There are some parallels between today's market and the market of the late 1990s outside of the dot-com crisis. I do want to review with you one of our investments, which is in India. And I want to tell you before I do that, that I am very sensitive to the human side of the COVID-19 tragedy. It is an incredibly difficult situation. I love India. I have been there and visited companies there. I'm on the board of Fairfax India. I love Indian food and the people. I love it all. And my heart and prayers really go out to anybody affected by COVID-19, whether it's in India or anywhere else. On the other hand, my job as an investment manager is to look for mispriced securities. And I do follow Uncle John's discipline of going to where the outlook is most miserable. And right now, you know, the outlook is pretty bad in India. So that is going to be the area of review for one of my stock picks. But I do find that very analogous to some of the things we saw in the late 1990s with the Asian financial crisis. So if you'll remember in 1997, there was no COVID-19, but there was a huge financial crisis referred to as the Asian financial crisis, which affected a number of currency and stock markets, including what started in Thailand with the devaluation of the Thai baht. But it spread to Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Singapore, and finally South Korea. And when it spread to South Korea, Uncle John really had been attracted to South Korea for a number of reasons over the years, and he decided that that would be a good opportunity to enter that market. And he did so in a variety of ways, including single stock positions. But he also identified a manager who ran a fund called the Matthews Korea Fund, and the manager was Paul Matthews. So the Asian, Paul had just launched the fund when the Asian financial crisis hit. I think things were pretty desperate. He evidently bought a ping pong table and played a bunch of ping pong. Things were depressing in his office. And in 1998, the fund had earned the high honor of being the worst performing mutual fund in the market. And that is the exact time that Uncle John decided to step into South Korea. And so he sent Paul Matthews a fax and said, you know, I'm going to put a ton of capital in your fund. And in 1999, the year of all the high flying tech funds, Matthews was the top performing fund in the market. So it's a good example of how you've got to use these events to put the odds of success in your favor. And that leads me back to India and one of our holdings there, which is HDFC Bank. So HDFC Bank is based in Mumbai, and it was founded in 1994. It's one of the leading private sector banks in the country, and we have held HDFC shares in our portfolio dating back to 2011. Okay, so we've held them for a while. And over this time period, the firm's earnings have annualized 21%. Since 1998, HDFC's bank earnings have grown at an annualized rate of 31.1%. One of the clear attractions to the bank is its growth rate, which is really owed to two different factors. The first is India's early stage of economic development, and the second is HDFC's bank's ability to gain market share from the less efficient public sector banks. Beginning with India's early stage of economic development, consider that domestic credit as a percentage of GDP is only 50.2% in India. This compares with 165.4% in China and 191.2% in the U.S. From a simple perspective of economic development, India's banking sector could experience exponential growth in the decades to come. We believe HDFC Bank's ability to maintain and grow its market share over time is rooted in early inroads among retail customers, while competitors have been focused on corporate credits, as well as deep commitment to technology and digitization across its franchise. The bank's focus is on speed and convenience, and its digital infrastructure enables the strategy. HDFC Bank sees 95% of its customer transactions initiated through the internet or mobile channels, compared with 35% only 10 years ago. The bank's model is increasingly modern, scalable, and set for future growth. Based on research from Deloitte, only 73% of customers globally use online banking. HDFC's digitization strategy drives more digital usage than the global average. HDFC Bank also maintains strong credit quality with 0.36% non-performing assets compared with 0.42% across all U.S. banks in Q1 2021. HDFC's bank's leading position across many financial products are being enhanced through its application of AI and bots, through virtual relationship managers, which currently have over 5.6 million customers. These technologies have created a 24/7 banking experience that continues to improve as more customers enter and use the service. I mean, I wish that we had a bank like HDFC Bank here in the United States. It would be convenient. I would use it. But U.S. banks are antiquated, and they're really stuck with legacy systems. So a bank like HDFC Bank is not stuck with all these legacy systems and can really embrace technology and digitization and focus on consumer experience. I mean, just today alone, I dropped my kids in carpool at their school and I had to get a medallion signature at my bank. So I had to go pull into the parking lot, eat my breakfast while I waited for the bank to open. They don't open till 9. Somebody came to unlock the door. I had to go in. There was a big process. HDFC Bank really has an edge here on customer experience and not being stuck with the legacy systems that U.S. banks are stuck with. I had some more data on HDFC Bank, and I don't mind posting this presentation to our website. So I will do that afterwards, and you can read more of our thoughts on HDFC Bank. But here is a simple chart of the bank. You can see that HDFC Bank trades at 3.23 times book value per share versus 3.54. Its average, which is on the left of the screen. So what are my final thoughts I want to leave you with? As we wrap up today, I think it's important to tell you that with the S&P 500 trading at 22.6 times PE ratio, compared with its historical average of 17.4 times, and that's over the past 50 years, I think the U.S. market is overpriced. But having said that, earnings growth could support the multiple, but it's very difficult to find a bargain in U.S. markets. On the other hand, international markets carry P/E ratios that remain in line or below historic averages. And it's not hard to see that these valuation disparities are owed at least somewhat to the factor of COVID outbreaks and vaccine administration across the geographies, which is really unfortunate. We believe that the UK and the emerging markets both appear attractively discounted and offer opportunity for investors willing to go searching for bargains. In the case of the UK in particular, its valuation really languished for approximately 5 years prior to COVID, due to the uncertainty surrounding Brexit. And it could be a really interesting hunting ground for investors. It's something we have our eye on. We own a position in Unilever. So those are my overall thoughts on the market. And I'm so happy to be with you today and happy to take a few questions at this point.
All righty. And we do have plenty of questions and comments built up here. Obviously, we won't have the time to get through all of them, but we'll do our best to hit on a couple of them. While HDFC is fresh in the memory there, we got a question here coming in right at the end of things now. Just asking when exactly you got into it and did you buy into it in multiple phases?
Yes. So we have been adding to the position for a long time. That's very typical of our investment strategy. So we'll initiate in a position, and if it falls in value, we will add to it. As I mentioned in the comments, we have owned HDFC Bank for many years, but continue to see it as a great investment in our portfolio going forward. So it's been in the portfolio a long time. And the reason I bring it up to you today is I think, unfortunately, because of COVID and the disruption in the markets, this is your opportunity to take a look at HDFC Bank.
Absolutely. And I'll go ahead and combine a couple of questions here into one, since they do all kind of hint at the same outcome. Overarching topic, though, would be looking back to the housing crisis crash. Are you, with things getting as overpriced as they are right now, expecting us to ever see a crash like that looking out into the future?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You expect those things. They're going to happen. And be prepared to take advantage of them when they do. Yes, absolutely. I'm expecting. Now, timing is everything. I'm not a market timer. No one is. People have really, really bad track records when it comes to market timing. But it will happen again. You know, for some of the nonprofit foundations that I work with, I'm always constantly reminding them, go ahead and model a 40% correction. Go ahead and model a 25% correction. It eventually will happen. And that way you've got your game plan. So I don't think people should get really focused on trying to time the market. Uncle John always said to me, or John Templeton, I'm a bad habit of calling him Uncle John. But John Templeton always said, and he put a lot of thought into everything he told investors. He always said that the best time to invest is when you have the capital. Don't focus on where the market is valued. Because I think he knew that the average person, if they tried to time the market, it wouldn't work out, right? Because you have to time it right twice, sort of. You have to know when to get out. You have to know when to get back in. And he also knew that the average person sitting there with a bunch of cash would find a way to justify to use it on something else, right? You can rationalize those decisions when it's better just to put the money in the market. And so I have to say, I think he was right in advising people to do that. That being said, I think you mentally prepare for huge corrections on bear markets, and you think through what it's going to feel like, you imagine what it's going to feel like, and go ahead and develop your game plan or your wish list of securities. So, you know, I'm going to be really scared, but I'm going to envision walking into my office and pulling out this list of securities and going in and putting in buy orders. During the 1987 crash, I love this story about Uncle John, but he was in the Bahamas managing money, and he had the habit of going walking every day for like an hour in the surf. He did it every day, and he actually had his shirt hemmed so that the water hit right below his shirt. And the day the market crashed in 87, he got up from his desk and he walked away. And he went to walk in the ocean, and his analysts were like, what is he doing? I cannot believe he's leaving. And so he came back from walking in the surf, and his analysts ran up to him and were like, "Oh, John, the market's crashing. Have you seen it?" And he said, "Boys, sit down." So good news and bad news. The bad news is we're in a bear market. The good news is it's almost over. Make sure you have your stock recommendations on my desk this afternoon. This is going to make our returns for years to come. So, you know, I think that should also be your philosophy when it comes to thinking about corrections and panics. They will happen. I do expect that they will happen. And I think we've already had, you know, a nice little sell-off in the market. And, you know, I fully anticipate a larger sell-off.
Absolutely. And a great question here, moving on from one of our usual viewers, Praveen. What is your process for raising cash during the bull phase so you can take advantage of these sell-offs?
Yeah, it's really organic. And I think you'll hear a lot of investors say this. It's organic. What does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. So our sell discipline is that when a stock approaches our approximation of intrinsic value, we start to look at liquidating the position, either trimming it or a full liquidation. Is there anything to justify staying in the stock? And then we sell the stock, okay? And so we're sitting on cash, but now we have to find a place to invest it. And guess what? The market, it becomes really hard to find a bargain because the market is pricier. And so the process slows down. Instead of being able to pull up your screens and do your research and find a candidate and invest the capital in 2 or 3 weeks, the process slows down because it's harder. And so it may take 2 or 3 months to find a replacement candidate. And by that time, you may have something else in your portfolio approaching your approximation of intrinsic value. So cash just builds kind of organically in the portfolio. And then there are times like today where we may have cash because, you know, we have an investor contribution and we're really struggling to find opportunities in the market. We don't want to add to existing positions. And we think as long as that cash position is under 10%, that it would be nice to have some dry powder. But it's usually not a decision that we're making. It's usually organic. We would love to put the money to work. We just can't we can't get it out the door fast enough, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And looking back towards the beginning of the presentation when we were talking process, we had a question come in, and you had mentioned kind of modeling out some 5 to 10-year PEs looking in the future. Is there any particular way y'all go about doing that you're at liberty to reveal to us?
I mean, not really. We're just projecting out earnings over a 5 and 10 year basis. There's nothing complicated about it. I would be happy if you email me the question. I'll send you back a very thoughtful example and a calculation of it. But there's nothing complicated about doing the 5 and 10 year PE multiple.
Absolutely. And it looks like here, let me see if I can break down this question here real quick. Oh, it does look like we have plenty more questions coming pouring in here at the end as well. And an absolutely positive request for that calculation. So I'm assuming you will be getting an email there from that person out there in the chat.
Let me share with you. This is our information. So, you can also, just email letsconnect@templetonandphillips.com. I get that email. And so I will respond to you there. I thought I had my personal email address there, which I'm also happy to share. It's ltemplton@ltfunds.com. But letsconnect@templetonandphillips.com ends up in my inbox as well. So please do send any questions. We're happy to share any of our calculations with you and explain anything that was unclear in the presentation. I love to engage with fellow investors. It's a really fun part of investing. And actually, the biggest benefit is the investment community. It's a really nice place to work. And I find that most people we engage with are super friendly and helpful, and we're all on this journey together. So I'd love to get feedback on the presentation. Don't be too mean, but some feedback and any questions you may have.
Absolutely. And we are running up against our time wall here, so we are going to round that out for the questions at this point in time. For everybody out there in the audience, if you want to swing back on things at any point in the presentation, anything like that, there will be a full recording available here on YouTube as well as on gurufocus.com that you can go ahead and take a peek at. We will get that link as well as that email address added into the description as well, so it's easy access for you guys. And do please feel free to reach out, like Lauren said here. She's happy to answer questions and would love to see that feedback coming from you guys as well. Without anything more today, thank you to our audience. Thank you, Lauren, so much for joining us today and taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure and was an absolutely wonderful presentation.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. And best to you and the audience as well as we move into the future. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.